So I'm going to hand over to Holden Shepherd, who's your host for the Day in the Life of a Best-Selling Author and the Day in the Life of a Bookseller, a Best-Selling Bookseller. Holden's YA novel Invisible Boys won the 2018 City of Fremantle Hungerford Award, and in less than 18 months has gone on to win the Kathleen Mitchell Prize, to be shortlisted for the Victorian Premier's Award, and longlisted for an Indie Book Award. He was the 2019 host of the Fremantle Press podcast and serves as the Deputy Chair of Writing WA. Please welcome Holden and Natasha.
Good morning, everyone. Can everyone hear me okay at the back? I've been told to speak into the mic. We've got a thumbs up. Great. So welcome. This panel is a split panel. We're going to be talking about selling, because this is a business of being a writer, and obviously the part of that business is selling the book. So we've decided to split this panel into two. We're going to talk about selling from two perspectives. Firstly, from the perspective of a best-selling author, and secondly, from the perspective of the people who sell the books for us, the booksellers. So before I go on, I'd like to introduce my guest for this first part of the panel. So before becoming a writer, Natasha Lester worked for L'Oreal, managing the Maybelline brand. She returned to university to study creative writing, completing a Master of Creative Arts at Curtin University, as well as her first novel, which won the TAG Hungerford Award for Fiction. Her first historical novel, A Kiss from Mr. Fitzgerald, was published in 2016, followed by Her Mother's Secret in 2017, The Paris Seamstress in 2018. She is now a New York Times and USA Today best-selling author, which deserves a round of applause in itself, I think.
Thank you.
And she has published all around the world. The French Photographer / The Paris Orphan is her latest book, and The Paris Secret is coming in just a couple of months, I believe.
Yeah, next month. Wow.
Next month. It's very soon. When she's not writing books, Natasha loves to collect vintage fashion, read, travel, dream about Paris, and have fun with her three children. And Natasha lives here in Perth. Natasha, welcome.
Thank you, Holden. Thank you, everyone, for coming.
So when I first thought we're sharing a stage together, I thought, this is interesting because you are high fashion and I'm a little grunge sometimes.
But very colourful.
But colourful. But then I thought we have a lot in common as well. We're both writers, very ambitious writers. We both love France and we've both won the Hungerford.
Mm-hmm.
So before I talk about the Hungerford, because I want to start there a little, but before that I wanted to ask, you said you started writing when you were very young.
Very young. In fact, I always tease my mum about being a hoarder, but I've had to eat my words in the last few years because hoarding means she's kept all of my very early manuscripts, including Mr. Men Go on a Picnic, which is my very, very first book. Very successful, very popular. I'm sure you've all heard of it. So basically when I was a kid, I was the ultimate fanfic writer, obviously copying Roger Hargreaves with this one. I wrote lots of Enid Blyton knockoffs as well because I was obsessed with her for a long time. So I am one of those people who my dream since I was, you know, since I could pick up a book and read it, my dream was to become a writer. So very lucky that that dream actually came true.
And I want to extend on that early dream of you know, Mr. Men Go on a Picnic. You know, you've gone on to then win the Hungerford in 2008.
Yep.
Did you think when you wrote that first novel that, you know, just over a decade later you'd be a best-selling author overseas? Was that ambition always there?
No, do you know what? I never, in fact, when my American editor emailed me to say that the Paris Orphan had made it to the New York Times bestseller list, she said in that email, so now you can cross that off your bucket list. And I was like, it was never actually on my bucket list, because the thought of a writer from Perth making it onto the New York Times bestseller list was so far beyond any of my wildest dreams. Like I did have dreams of, you know, people reading. I guess I became a writer because when I was reading a book, I loved the way that you would just literally escape into another world and your real world didn't exist. And my ambition to become a writer was to make readers feel the way that I did when I was reading a book. So that was kind of my dream. And then all this other stuff that's happened around it, you know, has just been amazing, but was never No, I never sat down and wrote, I'm going to be a New York Times bestseller. But so after my editor emailed me, I did write it down and then I crossed it off so I could feel like I was crossing off my bucket list.
Goal achieved. You can take it off the vision wall. Oh, that's fantastic. And I think a fascinating part of your story is not just that success that's come with the historical fiction, but the fact, and I think it's perhaps interesting for writers in the room, you didn't start writing historical fiction. That was a rebrand for you.
Yeah.
So you wrote a couple of books first. What led to that decision and did it lead to this success?
So my first book was this one here, What Is Left Over After, which Fremantle Press published, and that's the one that won the TAG Hungerford Award. And we're so lucky here in WA to have that award because, I mean, that kickstarted my entire writing career. I still look back to the day that I won that award and think, you know, if it hadn't have been for that, I probably wouldn't be sitting here right now. So, you know, all kudos to Frio Press for doing that for us. We're very, very lucky.
We've done our plug now.
Yeah. But so I wrote this, which is more sort of literary contemporary, and then I wrote another book with Fremantle Press, which was a similar kind of thing. And then I wrote a third book, which was in the same vein as well. And I was a really... I didn't have the difficult second book process. I had the difficult third book. I hated every minute of writing that third book. It was a really hard slog and I lost the love of writing when I was doing that. And so I ended up throwing all 85,000 words of that manuscript in the bin, which was probably one of the most devastating moments of my life. But I look back in retrospect now and I can say it was the best thing I ever did, throwing out that 85,000 words, although I didn't feel like it at the time. I did cry. But the reason was, I guess, because I'd written my first book as part of a university master's degree, there's an expectation about the kind of fiction that you'll write in a university environment. It's supposed to be quite serious and people are supposed to be quite sad and bad things are supposed to happen and no one's allowed to laugh, really. Well, back when I was at uni, that was kind of what you were supposed to write. So that's what I kind of did. And then I just kept doing that unconsciously, I guess. And then when I threw that book in the bin, I thought, actually, I don't want to write that kind of book anymore. What if I stopped writing the book that I thought that I should write and that I thought I was supposed to write and actually wrote the book that I really, really wanted to write? And just kind of giving myself permission to write what I wanted to led to me writing my first historical. And that was a completely different experience to that book that I threw in the bin. I loved every minute of that. It was the best thing ever. I got up in the morning and I couldn't wait to sit back down at the computer and start writing, and I refound my love. So I was like, okay, this is what I was meant to do. And I think that when you love what you're doing, it shows in the writing and the reader feels that. And that's a really important part of being a writer, writing what you love.
That's such a good point, and not just the pivot to historical, but I noticed that a lot of your recent books, you know, you're a Francophile.
Yeah.
You love France.
Yeah.
I love France.
Yeah.
Is it important, do you think, for other writers, if they're experiencing that same, that feeling that, you know, I don't love what I'm writing, should they find what they love, and does that help you to have career longevity, do you think? Does that contribute to that?
I think so, because, I mean, writing is a really hard slog. I mean, it was 5 years from the time I started writing that first book to the time it appeared on shelf. So if you don't love what you're doing, 5 years is a long time to be stuck with something. I mean, it's like a child, you know, you can't kind of get rid of it. So you've got to love it. And I have three, so I'm allowed to say that. but, you know, even now, you know, so The Paris Secret is, I think it's my seventh book. But I would have rewritten that. It would have been about the sixth draft that I sent to my publisher. And then it would have gone through at least two major structural edits, plus a copy edit, plus a proofread. And because I'm such a control freak, I then always reread it after the proofread. So, you know, you've read your book 11 billion times before it goes out on shelf. And if you don't love your book, you can't read it 11 billion times and invest in it every time. So that love is important to get you through all of those rewrites, all of those rereads, and to still then be able to get up on stage and talk about it like you love it.
Yeah, good call. And even then sometimes I remember doing my proofread going, do I have to?
I know.
Do this again?
I know.
Something that really has always impressed me about the process that you have is that you have so many projects on the go at any one time. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you tend to be promoting one book, editing or writing the next book, and planning the third one.
Yep.
Can you please tell us how the hell do you do this? And how do you become so productive and so effective at your writing process?
I think the way that I've become productive is kind of by accident. And it was because... so when I was writing this first book, I had three but kids while I was writing the first book. And I wouldn't recommend doing that to anyone out there who might be considering writing a book and having three babies at the same time. But it was actually the best thing I ever did, because it meant that the whole time I was writing that book, I could only write when the kids were asleep. And in fact, I used to have a blog in the early days called While the Kids Are Sleeping, because literally that was my writing time. And so my kids would go down for their day sleep, and that might be an hour and a half, and I would literally sit down at my desk and write as much as I could, as fast as I could, in that hour and a half, and I wouldn't even let myself go to the toilet because there wasn't enough time to pee, because it was so valuable, that writing time. And the thing that it taught me was discipline, and that getting a book written comes down to sitting down on a chair with your bum stuck there and getting the words onto the page. If you can't afford to wait for the muse, you don't wait for the muse, and you figure out that the muse turns up when you do. And so now I still am in that habit of not wasting time, because I spent so many years knowing that I didn't have that time to waste. And I thought it was the worst way to write a book at the time, in these 1.5 hour chunks, always pressured, always wanting more. But I don't know that I could be as disciplined as I am now if I hadn't have had that kind of training, I guess. So, yeah, I do usually have three books on the go. Like, for instance, right now I'm writing a book that will probably be out in 2022. I am editing next year's. That's 2021, isn't it? And, yeah, I'm in the midst of getting all the early publicity stuff done for the book that's coming out next month. So three sets of characters in my head, and I've got to remember which ones I'm talking about at any one time.
So impressed. Something you do really well as your social media. So you're on social media, if not every day, almost every day. Can you talk, you know, for the people who are wanting to start promoting themselves and get out there publicly as writers, you know, what do we need to know about social media? And I guess off the back of that, what do we need to know about personal branding as well?
Yeah, I think, my background was marketing, like Holden said when he introduced me. So for me, social media is kind of fun, because it means I get to use all my marketing skills that I spent, you know, 10 years working in and did a uni degree and everything in. But I think, you know, the reality is these days is that publishing companies' marketing budgets are very, very slim, particularly for first and second and often third time writers. And as you progress, you know, in your writing career, you'll start to get more and more marketing budget. I'm really lucky in the position I am in now. For example, the book that's coming out next month, we've got a full page ad in the Australian Women's Weekly, and that's the first time I've ever had that, and that's like a $50,000 placement, and I'm like, woohoo! But, you know, I would never have even dreamed of that back in my first book. So if you aren't out there doing things on social media, then it's really hard to have people find out about your book, because, you know, the publishing companies would love to spend lots and lots of money on everyone's book, but the reality is they don't have lots and lots of money to spend on everyone's book. They will do everything that they can possibly do for you, but it's great if you can also reinforce and support and supplement what they're able to do for you. And also, it's just really nice to chat to readers. I mean, do you know what? One of the things that gets me through my worst writing days, when I feel like everything I've written is absolute shit and I'm the worst writer in the whole world, is usually on that day, for some reason, I'll get a message on Facebook from a reader who's just finished reading one of my books and will tell me it's the best book they've ever read and how much they love it. And whilst I don't believe it really is the best book they've ever read, it's enough feedback on that day to make me go, okay, you know, pick yourself up. You're not the worst writer in the world. You can keep doing this. So there's that kind of, you know, nice positive reinforcement side as well. If you're willing to put yourself out there and share parts of the writing process with readers, then they will share wonderful things with you too, which is really great.
It is a nice back and forth process.
Yeah, it is.
Do you, when you're having those days where you feel like all the words are shit and it's not working, do you give yourself kind of permission to go, look, it's a first draft and just let it be? Or do you kind of self-edit and try to make it better?
Oh, no, absolutely. I'm total, shitty first draft writer. I don't even print my first drafts out, because I don't spell check them. I don't fix up grammar. They're full of typos. It's literally just about, for me, I'm not a planner. I don't know what I'm writing until I've written that first draft. So I have to write the first draft to know how to edit it. There would be no point in editing this misshapen, malformed, terrible piece of writing that, you know, has some potential but isn't anywhere near what it should be in that first draft. So, no, it's all about just getting the words out. And sometimes that can be really hard, because usually you're writing a first draft off the back of having just finished proofreading and polishing the last book. So you've got this amazing, polished, wonderful book of yours that you've just left off, and now you've got to sit down and write this terrible draft, and you think, oh, it's not as good as that. But of course it's not, because that's been, you know, rewritten a million times. This is the first go. So I think I love what Elizabeth Gilbert says about the self-doubt will never leave. You just have to let it come with you for the ride, but tell it to step forward when you need it. So when you're redrafting, then you need that editing critical voice. But in the first draft, you just have to say, wait your turn, you'll get your turn later. So I kind of try and remember that when I'm doing that first draft.
It's valuable advice.
Yeah.
Reminds me of, I think it was Stephen King. I could be misquoting because I do that a lot. But I think it was Stephen King who said the first draft, you're telling yourself the story.
Yeah, that's right.
Second draft, you're thinking, what is the story for the reader?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That first one's all about you.
Yeah, it
is. Understanding it.
And for me, there's no point editing that, because I don't even know, you know, if I'm writing the chapter three, who knows whether that's going to be chapter three by the time I get to the end of the book. I might realise that I've started way too early and those first three chapters can just go in the bin. So there would be no point in editing those as I'm writing. And a lot of chapters do end up in the bin.
I bet. I'm the same.
Yeah.
I want to talk about world domination. because you used those words a few days ago.
I was joking.
I know. Well, I wanted to interrogate that. So I think you had, is it the Paris Seamstress that's just come out in German?
Germany, yeah.
Yep. And you're like, cool, this is my plan, world domination. So I guess I wanted to ask, you know, maybe a little bit lightheartedly, you know, do you have plans for world domination? But more broadly, you know, are you ambitious? And how is ambition regarded for writers? You know, a lot of us are ambitious. A lot of us have egos well before we're published ever. You know, where do we go with that? Like, what is
why
it?
Why are they snickering in the front row there?
I think they're looking at me. But in terms of ambition, you know, like, how is it regarded and why is it important? Like, why do we need that ambition to write?
I think ambition and being a writer are things that some people think shouldn't go together. And I think that's kind of wrong because I think there is sometimes an expectation that writers are meant to starve in garrets and they're meant to just want to write for the love of it. And I think every writer does write for the love of it, but the reality is when you've got three kids who are hungry, often you can't afford to be starving in a garret. And so practically you have to be ambitious, but also, you know, if you're going to spend 5 years writing a book, it's nice to have some reward from that at the end of the day. And certainly, you know, for my first book, I mean, Jane might be able to correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, I think maybe this sold around 1,500 copies. So over 5 years, I'm definitely going to be starving in a garret. But that's, you know, where a first book kind of starts and things grow from there. There are some very unusual writers who, with their first book, will sell tens of thousands of copies. But the reality for most writers is that it's going to be something below 5,000 copies. And if it's taken you multiple years, then kind of it's going to be a while before you're able to kind of feed your three kids. But having that ambition, I think it's good for writers to acknowledge that we can be ambitious. Nobody expects an accountant or a teacher to go to work and not take home a paycheck that's commensurate with the work they've put in. So I don't know why writers should be expected to go to work and not take home a paycheck that's commensurate with the work that they've put in as well. And, you know, I mean, I'm regularly up till 9:30 at night every night working because I, you know, now that I'm published everywhere around the world, it's more than a full-time job. In fact, I had no idea how much work it was going to be. So yes, world domination is definitely a goal. No, not really. But no, I've been really lucky. And I think one of the ways, you know, as we're talking about the business of being a writer, one of the ways in which writers make money is all of those overseas translations. They all add up. You get an advance for each of them, for every single book in every single territory, and it's just this amazing check that comes through each month. This will be the Slovakian advance, and this will be the Russian advance, and this will be the German advance. And you just go, wow, this is fantastic. You know, this is, you start to see how it becomes a really viable kind of career for you. And it's a bit of pot luck, those international translations. We had one of my books came out in, The French Photographer came out in Norway about 3 weeks ago, and Somehow it's been on the bestseller list over there for the last 3 weeks. Who knows? I love my Norwegian readers, wherever they are. So you don't really know, you don't have a lot of control over that process that kind of gets translated and you get this book and you can't read it and you go, I hope it's the same as the one that I wrote. And then you get these nice kind of, you know, messages from your overseas publishers letting you know how it's going. And it's quite crazy to think that there are these people, you know, freezing in Norway reading my book. Yay!
I mean, that must just be such a fantastic feeling. And I don't know, so many of us dream of that, so
yeah.
You're living the dream. Talking about Germans advancing sounds like world domination to me. I don't know. I do have one more question for you. So basically the way the split panel will work is that we'll have Natasha first, we'll have our booksellers next, we'll have some time at the end for a Q&A from the audience with the whole panel. So this is my last question for you at this stage. And that's about these guys, the fact that we've got so many writers in the room. What are your kind of top tips when you talk about advice for writers? What do people need to know? What do you want them to know about how they can succeed as a writer?
I think the first thing is you have to actually get the book written. And I know that sounds kind of silly, but I do a bit of writing teaching, and I think one of the hardest things about teaching writing is having people come to your courses and they're so enthusiastic initially and so motivated, and then they leave the course and you might see them a year later and they haven't done any more writing in that year. And obviously life gets in the way. But I think there are lots of people who want to be writers, but there aren't as many who will actually finish writing a book. And so finishing writing the book is the very first part of being a writer. And the second part of that is then being open to feedback. I cannot tell you how much of a better writer I am now as a result of all the feedback I've received from my editors, both at Fremantle Press and at Hachette, who I'm with now. Rebecca Saunders, my publisher at Hachette, is the most incredible woman, and I would not be half the writer I am without her. So feedback can make you a better writer, and feedback's where you get the feedback and you go and hide under your desk and cry for a day, and then you come out and go, okay, I'm a big girl, I can handle this, and then you look at it more objectively and go, yes, actually I can see how I can make my book better, and that's always the goal, I guess. So getting the book written, being open to feedback and being happy to act on that feedback. And I think, as we said before, you know, writing what you love, I think that's the one thing I could get everyone to walk away with today. That would be the thing. That's what's going to keep you going through to the end of the process. That's what's going to make readers fall in love with your books, because they'll be able to feel the love that you've put into that book.
That's such a nice note to end on. Thank you so much, Natasha.
My pleasure.
Please put our hands together for Natasha Lester. Okay, so we're now welcoming our lovely panelists of booksellers to the stage. Please come through. So at the end here we have Michael Earp. Michael Earp is editor of Kindred, 12 Queer Love Oz YA Stories, and contributed to Underdog, Love Oz YA Short Stories. He has a teaching degree and a master's in children's literature and has worked in bookselling and publishing for over 17 years. Currently works at Little Bookroom, and haven't seen you since we shared a stage in Melbourne, so hey. Welcome. Please welcome Michael Earp. Aisling Lawless has been working at Dimmicks Joondalup for 8 years and is the winner of the 2019 ABA Penguin Random House Young Bookseller of the Year Award. She has previously worked as a reporter for the Sunday Times and is now the Marketing and Events Coordinator for Dimmicks Joondalup. Please welcome Aisling Lawless. And Elise Cameron is a bookseller at Dimmicks Morley and at Dimmicks Joondalup, I believe, as well, sometimes.
Yes.
And Joondalup and Karrinup. And has run a number of events as well, including the Books at Bars events, loves curling up with a good book. So please welcome Elise Cameron. So I just want to start with each of you perhaps telling us just a little bit about your particular role, because each of you works in a different bookshop, in a different role. What does this look like? Because as consumers, we see the end process. We see someone buying the book or you guys selling the book to us. But what's involved? Michael, could I start with you? What does your role look like?
What is my role? Everything. For context, the Little Book Room's owner, Lisa Lambert, and her parents own two shops. The Little Book Room is a children's specialist bookshop, the oldest one in Australia. We turned 60 this year. It's pretty exciting. But 18 months ago, or nearly 2 years ago now, we opened up a general bookshop called Neighbourhood Books. And so the family own the two businesses, and between the two separate shops, we have 6 members of staff. So wow. It's a very small enterprise, and that sees me in the little book room, because children's books is my specialty, 5 days a week, pretty much doing everything from seeing reps for new release orders to replenishment orders, receiving the stock, stickering the stock, shelving the stock, pulling returns, processing returns, boxing returns up and sending them out, and serving customers, constantly being interrupted by the phone and saying no to telemarketers.
You're painting a really happy picture of this job, by the way. Aisling, what's it like for you?
I don't know how to follow that now. I work for Dimmicks Joondalup, and I'm the sales and marketing and events coordinator there. So I pretty much exclusively look after the events that we run at the store, which is the YA Book Club, Books at Bars, Meet the Author events with the City of Joondalup Library. And I'm there about 3 days a week. So that takes up the majority of my time. So that's chatting to publishers, finding out what authors are touring, finding venues, putting up ticket links, advertising, and then also looking at sales opportunities within our store and community partnerships. And as Michael said, constantly selling books, talking to customers, being interrupted by the phone.
Absolutely, thanks. And Elise, what about yourself?
So I'm officially the group manager of Dimmicks Joondalup, Karen Upper Morley, but I spend most of my time at the Morley store running it. So about 2.5 days a week I spend buying new books at the store, so like bulk ordering, seeing the reps and the new books, and then replenishing the titles. And then the other, I guess, 2.5 days I spend doing returns for books that don't sell, unfortunately. I do spend a lot of time with customers as well on the floor when I can, because that's the favourite part of my job.
There is so much involved with this job that, like, I never even knew. And one of the things you've mentioned, each of you, is talking about buying books or returning books. And this to me was fascinating, because when I was younger, I thought, so your book gets published and then it goes into the bookshops and that's it. That's actually not the process. No. There is a process involved, and distribution plays a big part. So how does this work? Could I ask you each to kind of, like, how does a book end up in a bookshop? Because they don't all go into every bookshop. They don't all get promoted the same way. How does it work?
I feel like the biggest part of the process is seeing the sales reps. I see them once a week, and they kind of tell me about the new books that are coming out. Generally, with local authors, they're aware of them, and so there's a special emphasis on buying these books. So, like, if they say, oh, you know, they're a Perth author, like with Holt's book and Natasha's book, books, we'll try and make an extra effort to stock those books so that we have the kind of local support. In terms of if they don't sell, we do return to the publisher generally, or won't reorder them after maybe like 3 months, and that's pretty much if it has not sold at all. And again, we try and make a special effort to keep local authors in store for longer so that we can promote them. Yeah.
That's actually fascinating. Yourselves, how does that work, Michael?
Yeah, pretty similarly. We rely heavily on the publisher's reps to show us the range, and then pick and choose from that list. At the Little Book Room, we very much focus on Australian publishing as much as we can, and in particular Melbourne authors wherever possible. But then it's also, we're also thinking about our customer base and our personal tastes, because we're the ones they're selling it all day, every day. So quite often a publisher will bring their latest smash hit and they tell us that this series has sold, you know, 100,000 copies, and I'm like, we've sold 2, because we don't, like, it's not one that we've connected to, or it's too commercial for our market, or whatever the case may be. Not all books work for us, and so in that case I might have it on the shelf for those people that come looking for it, but I know I'm not going to get a stack of it because it's not one that we gravitate to put in people's hands necessarily.
That's really interesting. So the market, your readership has dictates what's selling and what you're going to buy from.
And
there.
Another example of that is with picture books. As a children's specialist, we do especially well with hardback picture books, but out there in the general market, hardback picture books are the ones that are constantly bookstores telling, like, because I used to be a sales rep for a publisher, and so I know that bookstores everywhere are like, oh, hardbacks are too hard, can't sell them, they're too expensive, people don't want to pay that money. Whereas in our bookshop, paperbacks don't move for us. People want that gifty keepsake. So it, like, you really have to find your market and follow through on it.
That's interesting. Ashley, is that the same for Dimmicks Joondalup? Is there a particular market for your store?
I don't have so much to do with the book buying or the ordering, but I do know that if you do want to get your books into a bookstore, reaching out to the local booksellers or the bookstagrammers in the local area and, you know, perhaps sending them an advanced copy or connecting with them online or on social media, because if you can get someone, a bookseller or a reader who's really passionate about their book, they will then go to the store owner or the store manager and say, hey, I read this book, I loved it, I think we should stock it. You know, I'm prepared to hand sell it and promote it. Or if readers are coming in and going, hey, I've, you know, connected with this author, I love this book, can you get it in for me? The more that filters through to the store owners or the store manager, the more likely they're going to order your book in and stock it.
Great. So people should be, you know, requesting books where possible.
But on the same token, if people are like, feel free to hand out your reading copies, but do not expect it to be read. Like, it is unbelievable the amount of books we are given.
Are you saying you have a lot of work to do or something?
Yeah, because in case you didn't know, being a bookseller is just sitting around reading all day. So,
now, I want to talk about the way bookshops work and the fact that in a bricks and mortar bookshop, the books have to be shelved on a particular category or genre. So they have to fit somewhere in the marketplace and you have to decide where you're going to sell it. And I may even ask Natasha this as well, but from your perspective as booksellers, do you think writers need to be thinking about this as they're writing? Do you think they need to know what genre they're going to be in so it can be put somewhere very specific? Or is that up to the publisher or the sales rep?
I mean, I'm not a writer myself, and I know genre can be really tricky because not all books necessarily fit into one genre, yet in the bookstore we do have to shelve them in a category. But I think as a writer, if you have an idea of how you want to market the book or what genre you want it to be in, you're in a better place then to have that discussion with your publisher or your marketing team and be able to find the best place for it to be put in the store, and then that will increase your success. So having an idea of where you want it to sit or how you feel it should sit in the bookstores, I think is probably very important. I'm not sure if Michael would agree, being a writer as well.
No, it's different for children's books because they're grouped by age, and so you obviously have to have a clear age market when you're writing a children's book. But within that age category, say our middle fiction section, you have everything from World War II stories to Harry Potter, and readers do like certain things, and so you sometimes have to hunt for the fantasy books for this particular reader within the one section. But generally speaking, they're very happy to jump here all over the place, but it's the getting the age right. That's
the age range.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, I, again, don't have any experience as a writer, but I imagine it's a bit of both because we do, again, have to find a space for it in the bookstore, but also, I don't know, it seems like something the writer should think about a little bit, but is not, like, the whole thing they should think about.
I'm interested in Natasha's perspective as well on this as a writer.
Look, I think these days publishers and agents expect you to know what genre your book is, and there's a number of reasons for that. And the first of those being that if you're writing a book within historical fiction, let's pick that because obviously I know that genre reasonably well, there are certain expectations that a reader has upon reading a historical novel, and a lot of that will come down to the research, the depth of research, the accuracy of the research, how you might explain in an author's note where you may have manipulated time and events, etc. So if you don't know what you're writing, it's hard to then meet those expectations that readers have. And it's not like readers, when they pick up a book, sit down and go, well, I expected to have this, this and this. It's not a sort of a verbalised thing. It's just an intrinsic feeling that we have when we pick up a book in a genre. We kind of know what we kind of expect to be a part of that story. So that shows the publisher and the agent that you've read widely enough, that you know your genre, that therefore your book will meet those kind of broader expectations that readers kind of feel within them when they read books in that genre. But also, you know, publishers have to market a book and they have to market it to bookshops who have to find a place for it. And readers like to know, I mean, they like to know that it's a book that they're likely to be comfortable and familiar with, and so that's why you have the slew of blue covers 1 month and then yellow covers 1 month and that kind of thing going on. So, you know, there are trends, and it can make it easier just to be aware of those things. You would never write, you know, so narrowly to a genre that you become something else, but you have an awareness of your genre, I think.
I think it's, yeah, to avoid disappointment in the reader, I imagine. You've got to meet those expectations.
Yeah.
To our three booksellers, you're all in traditional bricks and mortar stores. And in recent years, especially the last decade, we've seen various threats or assumed threats to that space in terms of the viability of bricks and mortar bookshops. Things like, you know, your Kindles and your Kobos and Booktopia and Book Depository, etc. But bookshops are continuing to thrive. And so I wanted to ask, you know, what's the reason for that? And what is the role of a physical bookstore as opposed to just someone who can sell books online?
You're the events person.
I think bookstores are more than just retail stores. They really offer a community hub, a place for like-minded people, keen readers, book clubs to kind of meet and make new friendships. And we do that, as Michael mentioned, a lot through our events. Our books are bars and YA clubs are spaces that we're not just there to sell books. We're there to connect people and get everyone excited about and passionate about reading, which then leads to higher sales because everyone's chatting about books, what books they love, recommendations from each other. So these real community hubs, which I don't think other retail stores offer, but then I'm sure that these guys will expand on that. They're also a place where you can come and get personal recommendations from staff members. You don't get that online. You don't get that from Kindle. But being able to come in and chat to a person who is just as passionate about books as you are and find out and get them to give you a recommendation what you love, that's just so invaluable.
Yeah. Where's Amazon's book club with hot chips?
Or brunch. You do a brunch, don't you?
Or brunch. Yeah, like between our two shops, we do 10 to 15 events a month. It's a whole enterprise on its own, which just constantly brings people into the shop. And it is that personal connection because, yeah, with the recommendation side of things, sure, there are algorithms, but sometimes having a conversation with someone about what their experience on a particular day can lead to the perfect read for them, and you can't have that with a computer. And so, yeah, people are the heart of bookstores and what keep them alive, both the readers and the booksellers.
Nice. People, not algorithms.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely think it's about making that personal connection between readers and booksellers, because honestly, the recommending is the best part of the job. Like, you get to go out there and speak to people, and if you're super keen about a book, then you can pass on that passion to somebody else, and then you might get them into a genre that they're not, like, they wouldn't usually read as well. So you get them.
You're like a reading mentor, a reading guru for us.
Bookstores also offer that personal connection to the authors, because if you're a national online retailer and you're a first-time author, they're very unlikely to feature or stock or promote your book. But the local bookstores are the places that you can go as a local author, and they'll give you the time and the shelf space and help you promote it. So that's something else that they offer that other places can't.
Thank you for that segue, because that helps lead into my next question. So my next question is about authors interfacing with bookshops. Authors often have the opportunity to do like a signing. So either come in and stand there and do a signing, or you might host an event, or sometimes we might just say, hey, can we come in and sign some copies and, you know, do some photos for social media, that kind of thing. With regards to your own stores and your own experiences, what should writers consider in terms of preparing for these kinds of bookstore visits? You know, what's involved? How do these opportunities come about? Should we just rock up and be like, hey, where's my book? Why isn't it on the shelf? You know, what's the process? And maybe I might even ask Natasha for your input on this as well. You know, like, you know, you guys are busy. The phone's ringing. Is the last thing you need an author rocking up and going, hey, I'm here to sign and you don't know I'm coming?
It's always nice to have advance warning. Generally, if you're a published author, you'll have a publicist or even the sales rep who will get in touch with you at least a couple of days before and be like, I have this author. They're planning on coming in. Do you have the books on the shelf, firstly, and would you like them to come in and sign some stock? In terms of coming in and signing stock, there's really no pressure. You can just come in and have a chat. We're, you know, more than happy to take time out of our day to do that. And in terms of, I guess, in-store signings, the biggest thing is being prepared to engage with readers or engage with strangers, even at the front of the store. because sometimes we get people who will just expect that the people will come to them and people don't. They'll sit in front of the store with their selection of books and people just walk past because they lead busy lives and they're not too interested in seeing a stranger. So you really need to go out there and, I guess, make an effort to approach people and be like, oh, I have this book. Or we had someone not too long ago who had chocolates out the front to entice people in, which we'd definitely recommend. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. Yeah.
People are so simple, aren't we? We're so easily manipulated. There's chocolate. Come here. Buy my book. Ashley, what about yourself?
Yeah, I think we get a lot of emails from people wanting to hold, especially because our events have kind of taken off recently, and they see and they go, oh, we'd love to hold an event with you. But I think demonstrating that you're prepared to get engaged in the promoting the event as well is really valuable, rather than saying, can you organise an event for me and I'm not going to do anything. But also, perhaps with in-store signings as well, thinking about what's going on in the calendar year or any events that you can link your book up to. For example, if you write a book that really appeals to mothers and would be a perfect gift for Mother's Day, contacting your local bookstore for Mother's Day and say, hey, I'd love to do an in-store book signing. My book would be a perfect gift. And people around those times are much more inclined to want a personal gift. So getting a signed gift from the author. Tying it in with those kind of events, kind of thinking outside the box, can make it a lot more appealing to the bookstore, but also help you sell more books as well. So just thinking about that aspect.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's lots of emphasis these days on the work that the author has to do, but like for an event in the shop, we'll put it up on our social media, we'll host the Eventbrite listing so that we can take RSVPs. But other than sending it out there, we're not the ones with the personal engagement with other people. Like, we actually need you to drum up an audience. We have some people that will randomly see an author they've never heard of doing an event in our store and think, oh, that looks interesting, I'll go along to that. But generally speaking, it really is up to you to get the audience. Mm.
I'm curious, Natasha, about whether you've done in-store signings, because obviously, you know, we've both done things like events, yep. And with events, you know, that people RSVP and, you know, there'll be some level of people rocking up. But my absolute worst fear, yeah, as an author is doing an in-store signing for an hour and just sitting there at the, yep, table and watching everyone walk past and just, I'll just check my phone again then, will I? Yeah. Have you done that? And is it terrible?
If I can avoid an in-store signing, I will. Because literally, there is nothing that will make you feel more like a loser than sitting there for an hour and no one coming to talk to you. I'm taking chocolates next time. No, I mean, events are fantastic. And personally for me, over and above any social media, any other kind of marketing, events are the things that work the best to sell books, because you can... You become a person. You're not just a name on the front cover of a book, and they can hear your story about the book, and it makes the book more engaging. I mean, when I did my first events in the first year of publication, you know, I had some events where maybe 5 people came, but I still did the event. And you know what? Those 5 people that came are like my big time fans now, because they had this tiny intimate event with me and they've come to every event for every book in the subsequent years. And so nothing is ever wasted with those kinds of things. And I mean, it was a little bit soul destroying to have 5 people, but that was okay. You have to do all of that kind of stuff. But no, the in-store signing, oh my God, I love going in and just signing a big pile of books and then, you know, kind of leaving. But the sitting at the table is, torture.
That sounds torturous, absolutely. On the back of the events being the big thing, Ashling, you organise a huge range of events. You've done the books at bars, you've got a YA book club. Might have been a year before last, you got the Penguin Teen Showcase out here from Over East, which was huge. And even things like you had Jay Kristoff come to Lakeside, you had a Skype call with Bridget Kemmerer recently, so like really cool YA authors. Whoa. How important are these events to a book's success? And what's the benefit for readers, for authors, and for you guys as the bookseller? Why do them?
Well, as Natasha mentioned, events can be a huge part of the book's success. Obviously, there's a lot that goes into making a book successful, and events are just one part of it. But being able to reach a wider audience range that's what events are so fantastic for. So we have designed a series of events called Books at Bars. And they're designed to entice people who maybe haven't read the book of the author before, or haven't read any of the you know, haven't even heard of the author, but they still want
to come. But who like wine.
So we draw them in with a drink and some nibbles. But they are designed to be fun nights out, so people don't feel pressure, be like, oh, I don't know the author, I can't come along. They come with some friends, they have a good time, and then the author has an in-conversation. They chat about the book and their inspirations, and that really hooks the people there who might not have read them. And then after a glass of wine, they're more inclined to buy the book. And then they become big fans of the author. So just through those events, the reach of new people that you can get is fantastic. But also the publicity opportunities that come with doing events. So there's so many books published on a daily and a weekly basis that, you know, your traditional media, like your newspapers and the radio, are unlikely to do an interview or do a story on you. However, if you're holding an event in their local area, that's the news hook. And they're more inclined to do an article on you, and therefore the readership from those media opportunities increases it even more. So it can be hugely influential to the book's success. And then I think the second part of the question was...
What's the benefit for readers, writers, and yourselves as booksellers?
There's huge benefits for everyone. So the authors also get to connect with the readers. So having that chance to chat to your readers, find out what they like, what they didn't like. As Natasha said, that feedback is hugely invaluable, and just connecting with them. It's obviously very beneficial to the booksellers. In this tough retail climate, events are even more important to us than ever. Just engaging with the community, but also selling those books is very, very important. And the readers, I think, love the events, because getting to chat to their favourite author is not something that other industries or retail stores offer. You don't get to often meet the maker of the art and chat to them personally and have that connection. So it's this real fantastic holy trinity of, you know, the reader, the writer, and the bookseller coming together in one place and engaging and just creating that community between us all, which is something I think that, you know, bookselling is one of the highlights.
That's really cool. My two takeaways from this are, firstly, what you said about if you do an event, it gives you something to talk about in terms of, like, local news or your social media. You can talk about, hey, I'm doing something new. The second thing is, we seem to be circling back to humans are very easily manipulated. So chocolate and wine, if you want to sell books...
There's a reason all of our events have food or hot chips or something.
It's starting to become clear
food,
now.
Food, tea and books just go well together.
Fantastic. Well, it's working. Michael, I wanted to ask you about the impact your career has had on your process as a writer, because you wear a number of hats. You're a writer, you're an editor, you're a judge, you're a bookseller. Has working in the industry influenced the way that you write and that you approach your work, say, as a novelist, for example?
Yes and no. Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've learned so much from working in bookselling and publishing that I just intrinsically apply to my writing. I can see when something I'm working on is hackneyed or overdone and needs to be left, like, put to the side. I mean, I can see opportunities, but, like, the thing is, seeing an opportunity now, it takes 2 to 5 years to get a book out. Like, the same opportunities will not be there by the time you finish writing. And so at the end of the day, I have to just work on what is making me passionate and what sets a fire in me, because otherwise, there's no point in chasing markets, I don't feel. Did that answer the question? I feel like I rambled for a bit then.
No, it absolutely does. So, and I think it is so important that we don't chase trends, because, as you say, the time between something being so hot right now and then you writing that book,
the
opportunity is gone. So it's advisable to avoid it, would you say? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, just always be writing what you're passionate about, because I think that comes out in the writing as well. But also, one thing that I have found is when I see a gap in the market that I genuinely believe needs to be filled from a personal place, like, that's how Kindred came about. I was like, where are all the queer stories? Where, like, there's so many anthologies in the YA marketplace. Where are the queer ones? And in Australia particularly. And so I'm like, I'm going to do it. And so I just did it. I just did it, but it, like, took 2 years to get out. And it was so much work. But, yeah, it's just a matter of chasing your dreams.
it has worked so well for you as well, Kindred. I think you've got a panel on it today, don't you? Not to do a promo.
Yeah, but plugging another another event, 5:30 over there somewhere.
Thank you so much for that. Elise, I wanted to ask about, we talked about the process of getting books into shops and reps coming around. In the case of some people who will choose to publish their own books, so they'll follow self-publishing, indie publishing kind of road, and some people in the room might be doing that currently or be planning to do that perhaps, what does that look like for someone who is indie published or self-published to get their book into a bricks and mortar store? Is it hard for them to actually sell because they don't have the sales rep around? Like, is it a harder process for them?
I definitely think it's a harder process if you're self-published because you have to wear, I guess, all of the hats. So you have to be the writer and the publicist and the editor, and you have to do all the marketing. Whereas if you you get published, you have people that will help you with that. In terms of getting a self-published book into a store, we do get people sending through, we get a lot of people sending through emails, which is probably the least successful way. Cold calling is also not recommended. Definitely the best way to come in, if you want to get your book into the store and you're self-published, is to come in physically yourself with the book and ask to speak to the manager or the buyer and say, look, I have this book. And I guess you're also selling yourself, so you just... you need to be really prepared to promote yourself as well. And then, I guess, leaving a copy of the book with the store and then saying, oh, if you get a chance to read it, you know, that'd be great. If not, no pressure, because we do get a lot of books to read from publishers and self-published authors. So we will do our best, but it's definitely a challenge getting through them all. But the biggest thing would probably be you have to market yourself. So you're going to have to do all the social media. We're more than happy to do events. We have done in-store signings with self-published authors before, which is also a good way to get new readers. But it's definitely, I think, more challenging, for sure.
For sure. So many hats to wear at once.
Yes.
Yeah. I've got one more question for our booksellers, and then we're going to open it up to questions from the audience. We have a roving mic, don't we, Claire? Yep, great. So just start thinking about questions now. So my last question is, as booksellers... what is something that you think perhaps writers don't know about the bookselling process, or what's something that you could tell us that would help us? No pressure.
That was the hardest question on the list. I mean, I think we've covered it a little bit, but just like that, I don't think a lot of people realise how busy and how much goes into running a bookstore. So you might walk in and it's a nice, quiet, calm oasis and people are like reading the backs of books and all happy. But behind the scenes, there is so much going on, as these two have talked about, returns and ordering, and it's kind of non-stop. So just bringing your book in and putting it on the shelf and expecting it, especially if you're a self-published author or a first-time writer, and just putting it on the shelf and expecting it to sell, it's not going to work. You have to, as we've covered, you have to be engaging and connecting with the local reading community as well. If you just plonk it on the shelf, it's not going to move. People will come in 6 months later and be like, has it sold any? No, but there's lots of other books that haven't sold either. So just being prepared to, promote yourself and help us out will help you, but you've got to help us out as well.
That's great advice. Thank you. Michael?
I mean, I am also a writer and wanting to be out there in the marketplace, so please don't take this as too nihilistic, but you can't expect anything really from bookshops. Having worked on both sides of publishing and bookselling, and then as an author as well, it's like the amount of books that we get shown, Penguin Random House alone will show over 500 to 600 books a month. That we have to weed through and decide, like, there is financially and physically not the money or space to stock all those books. So, like, we really, every bookshop everywhere has to be super selective in what they put in their shop. And so, please make yourself known to us, particularly if you live locally, but at the same time, like, show that you're engaging with us as well, because the amount of people that will walk off the street and say, hi, I'm a local, stock my book, and I don't know them from a bar of soap, and I'm there 5 days a week. So, like, where's you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours kind of thing. Like, And then when I get attitude because their book is not on the shelf, it's like, well, I'm sorry, but there's only so much I can do.
Yeah, the authors that are most successful are the ones that have engaged and built a relationship with us even before their book comes out, and Holden's a fantastic example of that. He came to our YA club and we knew him before he had his first published novel. He was writing and, you know, publishing some short stories, but he'd connected with us as a writer before Invisible Voice came out. And so when that came out, we were absolutely delighted because he was part of our community and we could, you know, fully promote his book. So, yeah, just that engagement. And telling your readers as well to engage with the local bookshop, because we all work together and make each other as successful.
Thank you. Elise, anything to add to that one?
I don't think I've got anything to add to that.
They've said it so well. Yeah. Okay, so we are now going to open up to questions from the audience. I know we've got... Do we have two roving mics? Yes, we do. Cool. Okay. We've got one. There we go. Claire's over here.
Hi. My name is Ashley.
Might just turn it on.
Secret methods. My name's Les Davies. Personally, and I don't mean to offend anybody, but I never ever buy a book with a bare-chested man wearing a cowboy hat on the front. How much does the picture on the front of a book and the blurge on the back of a book affect your buy-in prospects?
Interesting.
I think it's surprisingly important. I think we always judge, even though we don't mean to, we always judge the front cover as soon as we see it.
That's
even
like the one rule we're not meant to break, isn't it?
Even as booksellers, you see it coming in and you're like, oh, so pretty. And then the blurb, if it doesn't get you hooked within the blurb, then it's you're not going to read it, I don't think.
Mm.
Yeah, it's just how we are.
Natasha, do you have an input into your covers?
Oh, I have a lot. I'm very lucky. I've just got a great publisher who we work together really well, and so even before she briefs the cover designer, we will have sent photos back and forth to each other that evoke the mood or some element of the story that we think is important. And so we have this kind of picture board, and then she writes the brief and she shows me the brief, and then she won't show me any designs that she's not happy with, because she's probably even more of a control freak than I am. So if she's not happy with it, then she knows I won't be. So usually what I see is pretty much the final in the end, but because we've put all the work in up front, it always comes out to be something that I like. And there's a whole covers app meeting that the publisher will have, because the cover has to be signed off by sales and everybody has to be on board with that, so it's not just what the publisher wants. So it's covers are quite a complicated process. It's not just a designer sticking a picture on and going, here you go. You've got to please the author, the publisher, the sales team, the bookstores. In the US, there are bookstores that are particularly powerful and can change covers, and I've had that experience. So there's a lot of factors that go into covers.
Michael, Aisling, do you guys veto book covers and make the publisher change them?
I'd like to think we have that kind of buying power, but we do not. I do know that, you know, that type of thing happens. But, like, with Kindred, for example, they asked me for input and what my vision was for the cover, and I spent an hour crafting this email and went on forever, and... all of their first suggestions completely disregarded all of it. But that's fine, because all of their suggestions... I ended with just basically let the designer go to town with queer as the concept. And so I was very happy with what we ended up with. And it's had such a fantastic response. So, but as far as the importance to whether it works in the shop and seeing people engage with books at a store level, I think it's one of those things that is vital but also very hard to define in what way people respond to things, because it is about setting up reader expectations. You will quite often see historical fiction with, you know, a figure in a particular outfit or scenery from the place where it's set, you know, that type of thing, because people want to go into a book with some level of expectation about whether they're going to enjoy it or not. not many people want to pick up a book that they're thinking, oh, well, this was not for me, but here we go. the amount of times I have to read books, and that's my mindset, it's not a pretty place to be. But then maybe this is where I confess terribly that I don't read blurbs. I'm not a fan of reading blurbs. I like to judge a book by its cover, and I like to be surprised by plot entirely. I don't like knowing anything before I start reading.
That's fascinating. So all of you are judging books by their covers. It's amazing. We do have another question over here.
Hello. I'm Andre. I'm an event organiser at the Perth Comic Arts Festival. So I was just really interested to hear from our booksellers about anecdotally how they've seen the sales and customer interest in the sequential art, comics, graphic novels kind of sections that we've seen pop up in bookstores.
Booming.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Definitely. It's probably not my area of expertise, but what I can say is that the increase of people asking for that and interested in that is huge. And definitely an area I know myself that I need to probably brush up on because, yeah, the level of how that's increasing is massive.
Yeah, I mean, I keep coming back to, because I'm in a children's store, but our middle grade graphic novels is just so popular. They're really hard to keep on the shelf. Made huge by like the Smile series by Raina Telgemira. So basically anything in that vein will just keep flying off the shelf. But also parents, the stigma around graphic novels is beginning to decrease, which is amazing. For such a long time, they were just viewed as just pictures or, you know, frivolous comics, which is ridiculous. They have words in them too. And even if they didn't, it's visual literacy. So there's so much to take from a graphic novel. And yes, it might be read in 15 minutes, but it will be reread so many times that it's like unfathomable.
Yeah, and I always tell the parents that are worried if their kids are reading that, I said if they're passionate and they're excited about reading something, it doesn't matter what they're reading. Yeah.
It's getting them reading, absolutely. We have got a question in the second row, I believe.
Hi, Kevin. Just wondering the impact on the volume of swearing that you put into a book. How does that impact selling and distribution in the bookstores?
Interesting. I'm going to avoid answering that one. I'll let the panellists answer. I'm just the moderator. But is there an impact? Does the swearing reduce the people who are going to buy a book?
I'm not sure in terms of adult novels. I do know that because we do the YA book club and we sell a lot of YA in our store, is you get a lot of readers who maybe are capable of reading it, but whether the content in it is suitable for them. So that's probably the only time that I consider it is the, you know, the language and the themes in it are suitable for the child of that age, even though they technically can read the level of it. I haven't really thought about it in terms of adult books before.
Well, I mean, in terms of general adult books, this isn't even my area of expertise, but you only need to look at Christos Tolkis as a national bestseller and to know that apparently swearing is not a thing to worry about when you're writing for adults. And as far as writing for kids, I mean, young adults, there's always some scattered in. A little too much can be overbearing and mean that I have to warn parents, but usually swearing is not what parents are concerned about. It's other content that they're keeping an eye out for. But yes, swearing, as long as it's in context, I don't see an issue with it.
Can I just say something on that? It's quite different for the US, and I found this very surprising because I started to get emails from US readers about how dreadful the swearing was in my book, and they're historical novels, so really there's a limit to how much swearing you can put in there that's contextually accurate. I'm like, what? And then I realised how damn is a particular, and hell are particularly problematic words for a certain sector of the US readership that are very deeply religious, and so something that, a word that we wouldn't even consider to be a profanity over there is deeply, deeply profane and will prompt some very intriguing emails in your inbox, so beware.
There is, look, there's a lot I could say if you want to ask me about. I can say so much about this, but the panel's not the time to say it. We have two more questions. We've got not much time, so I'll have to make them relatively quick questions, if that's okay.
Hi, so Natasha, I was just wondering with your social media how much time you spend on it daily? And what kind of, like, do you just post what you're doing in terms of your progress with a book or something like that?
I actually spend, people always think that I spend a lot more time on there than I do, but really it's maybe 5 minutes a day, and then maybe another 10 minutes later just to reply to everybody, because I always reply to anybody who responds to my social media, because I think that that's part of interacting with your readership. I think it's really important. But really for me, I don't find social media hard, because I'm just literally taking a photograph of what I'm doing that day and putting it up on social media. So it's not anything that I have to plan for or prepare. It's literally I'm researching this beautiful dress, and so I'll take a photo of that and put it up, or I'm starting a new book, so I'll take a photo of literally Scrivener open on my computer, or I'm reading, you know, Catch and Kill by Ronan Farrow. I put a picture up of that a couple of days ago. So it's just my life and what I'm doing, and I think that makes it easy. It doesn't make it a burden, and people like seem to be interested in that, particularly when they're beautiful dresses, so that's kind of nice. Yeah, so it's not tricky, difficult. It's a part of my life that I can manage quite easily. So mm-hmm. That's how I approach it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and we've got one final question towards the back.
Hi, Ewan. My name's Alex. Firstly, I just want to say, Holden, nice hair. Who knew West Coast was a good colour for you? this question is mostly to Natasha and Holden, but it does apply to the panel. What advice can you give new authors about managing your expectations on how well a debut novel will sell, or how poorly, for example?
So much to talk about, Natasha.
Oh, so many. Yes, so many answers I give to that. Look, I think it. I don't think it's possible to have any idea how a debut novel will sell. I don't think anybody really does, because there are so many, there are debut novels that suddenly become these amazing bestsellers, and then there are debut novels that publishers think will do well and don't do well, and then there are the majority of others that basically just kind of meet expectations. So I know for me that when my first book was published, you know, I was just so hugely grateful that this book was going to be on a bookshelf and people were actually going to buy it, that it was an incredible thing, and that particularly then followed through to my debut in the US, where I literally thought that we would sell two copies, because why would anybody in the US buy a book from a Perth author? And so my expectations were so low that actually it was going to be pretty easy to exceed them. In hindsight, I look back and think that now. And, you know, that book went on to sell something like 200,000 copies over there, so a lot more than two. So I think that the more you can just come to these kinds of things and get a realistic idea, it doesn't mean a book is a failure just because it appears to sell a smallish amount. It can be still a very successful book for a small publisher, or a very successful book in that genre, or a very successful book in a particular state or a particular set of bookshops, and then that's what you build on. So it's a long-term investment writing, and, you know, like I say, I'm onto my seventh book now, but for me, it wasn't until The Paris Seamstress, which is like my fifth book, that really I was starting to make anything that could be called money. So that's a number of years. That was 2018, and my first book came out in 2010. So it's not a kind of a short-term proposition, I guess. Yeah. But, you know, if you love it, you're happy to just keep doing that.
Yeah, I think that's a great note to end on. I guess my comment would be that it's a lot harder to sell books than any of us think, especially when you're a debut. I was lucky enough that mine did go into reprint within the first week, I think it was. But even then, you're not selling 200,000 copies of a debut novel.
Yeah.
So like a writing career in terms of sales, it really does build up, and it tends to be someone's fourth, fifth, sixth novel that suddenly they emerge and they're selling truckloads.
Yeah.
And then from there, you're going gangbusters. So I think that's a great place to finish this on. Could we please thank best-selling author Natasha Lester. And our three booksellers, Elise Cameron, Aisling Lawless, and Michael Earp. And I guess my final note as well would be, in terms of booksellers, support these guys. Buy their books. Go into your local bookshop and buy their stuff and interact with them. And in terms of our local booksellers, I'm pretty sure Kindred and Natasha's books will be on sale in the bookshop today. So please do support them and buy their books. Thank you all very much for coming and being a part of today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Holden. And a round of applause for Holden. Well done, you. Thank you.